I'm Dr. Leif Tappanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Zach Lockyer, Regional Wildlife Manager at Idaho Fish and Game. Today we'll be talking about hunting in Idaho, from elk to forest grouse, and everything in between. Peter, welcome. How are you doing?
Great. Are you an avid hunter?
I am an avid eater. I have friends who hunt,
yep.
And I deeply appreciate it when they bring tasty things to my house.
I am right there with you.
I'm a lazy appreciator of hunting.
I say thank you. I say thank you when they bring me tasty morsels.
That's good. Well, before we get kicked off into our topic for the day, Peter, why don't you tell us about some nature news?
This is really kind of fun and cool. Stone tools and artifacts have been unearthed at an archaeological dig in our very own Cooper's Ferry, Idaho. What they found is that these artifacts are around 16,000 years old, about 1,000 years earlier than what people thought were the first residents of North America.
Interesting.
So they challenged the long-held Clovis First theory, which stated that our early American migration came kind of through the middle of North America between a gap in the ice sheet. What they're saying now, what they think, is that 1,000 years earlier or so, they actually came across the land bridge and moved down the Pacific coast and ran into the Columbia River and kind of followed the Columbia River into North America and Idaho.
Yeah, that's an interesting new study that just came out, and I think it's going to take folks a little while to digest the evidence that they have, because anytime you have a new oldest to anything,
yes,
people kind of have to shake their heads and go,
We better carbon date this, we better look at that, yeah.
But what's interesting, though, is that we've got a deep history in this state, and there's always more, you know, there's more things that are coming out of the ground, and people are coming up with new ideas on how our past may have been. So I guess stay tuned, and we'll see how this shakes out as the science on it and the evidence matures a little.
Yeah, as the data comes in.
Very interesting stuff.
Yep.
You know, we like to do trivia on this show, and today is like any other time. Our trivia question today relates to hunting, of course, and one of our animals out here is the elk, and elk have ivory. What is elk ivory? We're going to address that one
later in the
show.
That's a great question. And I started my career off with elephants, and I know what elephant ivory is.
Absolutely. Well, I know what mammoth ivory looks like, because we've got lots of that at the museum. Well, let's throw to a break, and we'll come right on back and talk about hunting.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
And we're back. We want to welcome our guest today, Zach Lockyer, a regional wildlife manager at Idaho Fish and Game. Thanks for joining us today and telling us more about hunting. So first off, welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Your title, you're a regional wildlife manager. I know what the regional, and I know what a wildlife is, and I know what a manager is. So tell me how those three come together. What do you do?
So I'll start with the region, with Idaho Fish and Game. With the state, we have 7 administrative regions across the state, and I work in the southeast region out of the Pocatello office, and that extends north up to Blackfoot, west over to Arco, down to Utah, and back to the Wyoming border. So kind of that southeast corner of the state is the jurisdiction that I cover. And as a regional wildlife manager, I work with a team of wildlife biologists to monitor wildlife populations and understand how they're performing, if they're doing poor or well, why. For the species that we have hunting seasons for, that also includes setting season dates, tag levels appropriate, so that we have healthy wildlife populations for Idahoans to enjoy into the future, and also that hunting opportunity for those specific species.
Excellent. So that sounds all-encompassing. Like, there's a lot of wildlife, and so what animals are you covering under that management?
So it is incredibly broad. We're responsible for managing all of Idaho's wildlife. And so we work on things from pelicans and pygmy rabbits to elk and moose and everything in between, bats. So a lot of species that we don't have hunting seasons for, and also those species that we do. So it is very broad, and depending on what's a conservation need or what we get the best bang for our buck for. So if we're working on a habitat project for mule deer, that might encompass a whole bunch of other species in that umbrella. So some small game, some birds, some other species might benefit from that. So it is very broad, and an aspect I really enjoy in this job. Each day is very, very different.
I think it's important for people to understand, too, it's a holistic approach.
Yep.
When we think of fishing game, a lot of times we think of hunting and fishing, the licensing aspect of it, and forget about that it really is all of Idaho wildlife.
It is, yeah.
How are decisions made, I guess, on which animals are going to be more focused on than others? Is that made internally, or how are those sorts of decisions?
There's several pieces of information that influence that. We've got species management plans for the various species. Idaho has a lot of wildlife that don't just stay within Idaho's borders. And
right.
So we've got species that are managed on the federal level, and they coordinate with the states. And so a good example of that is waterfowl. And so waterfowl, ducks, geese, and a variety of species in between, they are surveyed across an entire flyway. And how they're managed in an individual state is in conjunction with the federal nexus.
Right.
And so it really depends on what species you're talking about. Internally, if we're learning that a certain species is maybe struggling, we've seen population declines, that might elevate it to a higher level that we need to focus on that species or try to understand what's going on. And funding is a big, big factor in what we do and don't work on.
Sure.
And I suppose you also have to work with a lot of NGOs and other not-for-profits or private organizations to really get some management done and some appropriate management done for some species conservation.
Yeah, we coordinate and work closely with NGOs, other federal agencies, private landowners, private individuals, and so whatever we can do to accomplish good things for wildlife, it's not just fishing game. It's a very broad group that works in wildlife conservation.
I think it's also really important with the private landowner cooperation. It really enhances and improves and can speed along the conservation process, because there's a lot of steps that you guys have to take, whether it's on the state level or the federal level, to really get a lot of these management plans put together. And if you've got the corporate cooperation of the private landowner, it really streamlines a lot of that process.
Yeah, and there's an abundance of Idaho wildlife that rely on private land at certain times of the year or maybe year round. And so those private lands can be very important for wildlife species. And so we do have a couple programs where we work closely with private landowners, make sure that they get to stay whole with their operation and make a living, but also do good things for wildlife.
A lot of your guys' funding comes from hunting and licensing.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about game hunting in Idaho.
Yeah, so Idaho has a tremendous abundance of hunting opportunity across the state. We're very fortunate to be here. I think a lot of people have moved to or live in Idaho because they get to enjoy the wildlife and the beautiful scenery and beautiful places we have to offer. And Idaho has a rich history and heritage of hunting, fishing, and trapping, and that holds true today. From big game, upland game, migratory birds, there's just a diversity of hunting opportunity throughout the course of the year. And hunters or just folks interested in hunting can find a lot of that information on our website. And we have opportunities that are very simple and easy and work really well with friends and family and kids. So things like forest grouse, one of my favorite things in the fall is just going up in the hills above town here and seeking out rough grouse and dusky grouse. And then there's more complex type of opportunities that require a little more planning and can be a little more challenging, like a moose hunt or a hard to draw tag for another big game species like deer or elk. Idaho has just a tremendous amount of opportunity. We try to emphasize opportunity and get people to interact with the resource.
Right. So one aspect of this management is having an understanding of what the base of animals is out there, right? And right. Making estimations on total numbers. I'm really curious on how you go about doing that. Is it based on, you know, somebody is counting, or is there a model that you use to make estimates? How does that work?
Yeah, we employ a variety of tools. You mentioned a couple of them. Some of the tools a lot of people might be most familiar with are with some of the charismatic big game like mule deer, elk, some of the large carnivores, where we capture animals during certain times of the year. We equip them with GPS collars. And that information has been really important, understanding how animals move across the landscape, what areas might be important in the summer versus the winter, fall, spring. It also tells us survival rates. And so using mule deer as an example, we have a subsample of these populations where the adult females have GPS collars. We also equip fawns in the winter with collars, and we get an estimate of fawn survival, adult survival, and that gives us an understanding of population trajectory, up or down. We also use a bunch of other information like hunter harvest. We look at predation rates and disease. And then we also, an important part of what we do is engage with our public. And so when we determine how many tags are appropriate, we look at that biological information, but we also engage with the public on what they're experiencing on the hill, what they would like to see different. And that's an important component as well. And depending on what species, some species we get more information, some less. Our upland bird species, what some folks might see if they drive around this time of year, are wing barrels. And so people that harvest upland game birds, they deposit a wing in a barrel for us. And from that wing, we can identify species, identify sex for some species, tell how old the animal is, the bird is. For some species, we can even evaluate whether, if it was a female, if she had a successful nest or an unsuccessful nest, and we can get an estimate of production. And so as we set seasons going into the next year, we compile all that information. We do have some models that incorporate weather variables and some other things. We can look into the future on how many of this species or this population we might have and appropriately adjust our seasons and take levels to reflect that.
It seems like a big challenging problem, you know, especially considering all the different animals that you would be trying to track this information for and the different modes of migration that they have. What a challenge that must be, and how helpful it is then to have, you know, people, the citizens, being able to help in that process of feeding information so that you get a better, more accurate count so that you can manage this. I'm curious, for some of the animals that are not in the hunted groups, what are approaches that are used for other, I don't know, I was just thinking when you mentioned pygmy rabbits. I know Idaho has sort of a population of these small rabbits. They're not in the hunted group, obviously. So how would an animal like that be managed differently, I suppose, or counted?
So an animal that we're not hunting, you can employ some of the same methods, but a lot of those species we're doing survey and monitoring work. And okay. So it's missing that season setting take component, but a lot of the strategies to understand how that population's doing might be the same.
Okay.
Pygmy rabbits, we've got a series of surveys that rotate from year to year, and we can check in on those places where we know that they occupy that habitat. Bats are another good example where we can go into caves or, you know, where they're hibernating, or maternity colonies different times a year. Some of the biologists use mist netting at night to assess bat populations. And so there's a lot of the tools are very similar for the species that aren't hunted. Another good example, in the southeast part of the state, we've got an abundance of birds and a broad variety of bird species. And we have a lot of colony nesting birds like white-faced ibis, cormorant, American white pelican. And so we can survey those colonies during the nesting time frame and see how those populations are functioning.
Do you also look at, you know, when you're looking at these areas and the number of tags offered, you look at the population of, say, the elk. Do you also look at the vegetation quality and food supply? Does that play a role when you start making these decisions on wildlife management?
Absolutely. Without quality habitat, we don't have healthy wildlife populations. And so we factor in those variables. We've got some pretty complex and high resolution maps that can look at really fine scale what vegetation is there, how's that vegetation changed over time. Has this aspen patch been converted into conifer? Can we work with an NGO or the Forest Service and enhance that once robust aspen patch, you know, back into a healthy, productive system that might benefit elk calving or deer calving? If we have a catastrophic wildfire, how is that going to affect how animals use the landscape and their survival? Do we need to modify seasons take and give those populations a chance to rebound or respond to that event? And so what's happening to the vegetation and the landscape very much comes into play when we're thinking about not just the species that we hunt, but all wildlife.
It is not an easy process, and it's not an easy decision-making process. So, you know, if someone wants to complain about the decisions for the areas, listen up. This is a whole large umbrella that you guys have to consider when making decisions on game hunting.
Yeah. Understanding wild systems that they're not closed. There's a lot of variables you can't control, and they're very complex, and so you need a lot of sources of information to just start to understand what might be going on. And it's important to engage with the public and other partners, because depending on their roles, what they're doing, they see things that we might not be seeing. And so, yeah, it's difficult to make decisions. It's not often black and white and straightforward. You have to look at a lot of different little pieces and try to understand what might be going on in a wild ecosystem.
So we're in the Southeast Region 7, correct?
Region 5. Yep.
How many areas within Region 5 do you guys look at and monitor and make these decisions on?
Across the entire region. The exception would be portions that are in the Fort Hall Reservation. But from private lands to public lands, from next to the interstate to the tops of the peaks, we're covering a large area. Yeah.
I'm wondering about the seasonality. And so here you have all of these variables that you're trying to measure directly or indirectly to come up with a decision. A decision as straightforward maybe is how many tags do we release for a particular animal at a particular time. And you have to gather all of that information, but one thing is fairly constant, which is the season deadline is going to come looming at some point. There's a hard deadline, and there's going to be a group of interested hunters, right? And they're going to want to be able to get a shot at a tag.
And they're all going to be happy.
And they're all going to be absolutely
always happy. Yeah.
there's a tag for everyone, I tell you. So there is that looming deadline, right? And so that's where the real world meets the, I guess, the prediction and the model and all the hard work that you've done to do the best you can to predict what the right number ought to be. Could you tell us a little bit about seasonality and the seasons that you have for game hunting in the state?
So Idaho Fish and Game, across the state, we collect all this information. It varies by time of year and species. And then we make recommendations, and the Idaho Fish and Game Commission actually sets those seasons.
Okay.
With seasonality, if we're talking big game hunting, as an example, we collect a lot of that information during the fall hunting season and then the subsequent winter. And then we're constantly getting feedback year-round from people. But a lot of our aerial surveys, survival data, is fall and winter. And then we're setting seasons for the next winter in March of the previous year.
Right.
And so in March, we're setting tag level season dates that the commission will act on for that next September. And if something happens, say a bad wildfire or something changes, the commission always has the authority to make an emergency adjustment. If
sure.
Does that kind of get at what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly it. There's this timeline, and then, you know, there's a lag between a decision being made and when the hunting season might actually start. And so that's a good example. A summer wildfire might really change circumstances that you couldn't have predicted.
Right, okay. Right. And yeah, so you're right. There's always a lag, and we're working on either current or prior year data, you
right.
know, so, you know, right now we're looking at 2018 harvest seasons and 2018-2019 winter survival. Maybe if we're talking about grouse, we're looking at our breeding surveys at Lex from last April to set seasons for this fall, this September, October. And so we need to be open to change and new information if it's warranted, if something happens.
That's interesting. Yeah, again,
it's way more complex than I would ever think. And even when you set the season, you're still collecting data, you're still monitoring, because as you said, something could change in the next 2-3 months. So it's not like you get to take a vacation once the seasons are set.
Absolutely. And there's things like a disease outbreak, say in white-tailed deer, EHD hit up north a few years ago, and we had a very high mortality rate over the summer. And I can't remember exactly what changes were or weren't made, but I'm certain that that event was taken under consideration if seasons and tag levels need to be adjusted.
So I wanted to ask about if there's anything new coming online in terms of new hunting styles. I know there's bow hunting, and there's muzzleload, right?
Yep, muzzleloader hunting.
And then, are there any new developments in hunting, new modes or anything like that that's coming online?
I don't know about new modes of hunting, but the technology has changed tremendously in the last couple decades.
Yeah.
And the tools out there that hunters have that they didn't used to have, and how that affects harvest.
Right.
A lot of that's unknown, and people are starting to look into that. But the technology with archery equipment, with modern day rifles, trail cameras, all those things are continually getting better and better.
For sure.
And I suppose even the all-terrain vehicles, the way you get to your area for hunting has changed too. It's not necessarily you're hopping on your horse and spending a week out there. You can go out and come back.
Yeah, and even lightweight backpacking tents and fancy lightweight Gore-Tex waterproof gear, and all of a sudden you know, you can spend a few more days or get a little further in than maybe you would have without some of that technology.
That's
and,
right.
And so just the culture and how people hunt and what they're able to do, I think that has shifted in recent past.
You know, I think what everyone should know and realize and enjoy is that you don't have to be an avid hunter to be an avid component to what you guys on Fish and Game are doing. Anyone getting out and hiking and camping, they can take notes. It's really like a citizen science project, you know,
right.
Passing information on to you guys. You don't have to be a game hunter to actually go out and enjoy Idaho and support Fish and Game.
Absolutely. The wildlife in Idaho belong to the citizens of Idaho. And whether you're a hunter or not, we're excited when people are interacting with that resource. And for people that maybe didn't grow up with a hunting background, haven't been exposed to it, if they're interested in it at all, this wildivore, locavore movement, we've seen more people interested in consuming wild game that they go and acquire themselves. We love talking to those people. People that are going out and recreating, they're great sources of information. They document observations of unique species. And so it's not just hunters. We interact with a broader public. Most of our funding comes from license and tag sales. But yeah, we want to see people interacting with the resource.
You know, we started off today talking about elk ivory. And our trivia question was about what that is. Could you maybe enlighten us on what elk ivory actually is?
It's just like it sounds, even though it sounds a little odd.
It's not an elephant, right?
Yeah, no, but they are remnant or relic tusks from their prehistoric ancestors. And so on the upper mandible of an elk, they've got two ivory teeth in the canine location. You'll hear people call them whistlers or blowers. Their ancestors, it was used as a fighting tool during the breeding season, and elk have evolved, and now they got these big antlers, and now they have these relic ivory teeth. They're very common for people to collect. You'll see them in jewelry stores, very common to make jewelry out of them. Some people speculate that the vocalizations modern-day elk make now are they use those ivories to help with those calls.
Yeah.
I don't know for certain if that's been verified.
All right. Okay. We want to thank Zach Lockyer, Regional Wildlife Manager of Idaho Fish and Game, for today's great information. And if you want to learn more about hunting and what Idaho Fish and Game does for wildlife conservation, please visit idfg.idaho.gov and click on the hunting tab. Shows are recorded here at the studios of KISU Pocatello. Visit us at kisu.org for questions, comments, and audio for all our programs. Our theme music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock, and please remember to get outside and enjoy the nature of Idaho.